interrogation, and they add that the state to which a man was reduced made the process of interrogation a fairly easy one for the NKVD. In fact, some of its work had been done for it already without its officers having to move a finger, a useful saving of energy in a hard-worked organization. Rosengoltz was left to sweat it out for many weeks. He was still at large in August, when he made several desperate efforts to get an interview with Stalin, later to be interpreted as an assassination attempt. On his wife, a jolly, red-haired girl, very imperfectly educated and brought up in a religious household, the weeks and months of anxiety must have been frightful. She did all she could think of. When her husband was finally arrested, the routine NKVD search revealed, sewn into his hip pocket, a small piece of dry bread wrapped in a strip of cloth. Inside the bread was a piece of paper on which she had written, as a charm against evil fortune, 8 verses from Psalms 68 and 91, ancient cries of the helpless against their oppressors. LX 8:1. Let God arise, and let his enemies be scattered, let them also that hate him, flee before him. 2. Like as the smoke vanisheth, so shalt thou drive them away, and like as wax melteth at the fire, so let the ungodly perish at the presence of God. XCI 1. Whoso dwelleth under the defense of the Most High, shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. 2. I will say unto the Lord, Thou art my hope, and my stronghold, my God, in him will I trust. 3. For he shall deliver thee from the snare of the hunter, and from the noisome pestilence. 4. He shall defend thee under his wings, and thou shalt be safe under his feathers, his faithfulness and truth shall be thy shield and buckler. 5. Thou shalt not be afraid for any terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day. 6. For the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the sickness that destroyeth in the noonday. Tilde. Closing in on the Politburo. As the tempo of the public side of the purge eased somewhat in the autumn of 1937, Stalin began to prepare the next phase. A number of figures, including Bukharin and Rykov themselves, were under interrogation with a view to public trial. A number of unsatisfactory Stalinists like Ruzadek and Antipov, though they were still perhaps resisting, lay ready as a possible reserve for the Bukharin case, or alternatively as the central figures of a later trial. But much remained to be done. The rank and file of the February, March waverers had been crushed. But the senior figures involved were still in positions in the highest leadership. Until they, and any others who had shown restiveness or independence, could be eradicated, there was a flaw, a weak spot, in the structure of autocracy. They were not, like Zinoviev and Bukharin, men long removed from the centers of power, or even, like Pyatakov, men long relegated to second-rank positions in the government and party. It is true that they constituted a minority and that, except for Kosyurzhan, previously, Postyshev's control of the Ukrainian machine, they had little grip on any true instruments of power. They nevertheless represented a higher potential of trouble than their predecessors. The one serious combination which Stalin may have thought remained was a combination of a group of moderate leaders with the army. Nor was the striking down of the army leaders in June 1937 entirely conclusive. Other commanders survived who could conceivably give trouble. In any case, Stalin proceeded with his usual combination of gradualness and ruthlessness. But first, certain technical moves were called for. Since the decree of August 1936, people had been making a nuisance of themselves by complaining that their snap trials and executions were illegal. At any rate, on 14 September a decree was issued to introduce simplified trial procedures, in cases under Articles 58, 7, 58, 8, and 58, 9, of the Criminal Code. It forbade appeals and also petitions for clemency, the right to which had been restored in 1936 with the object of deceiving Zinoviev and company. More interesting still, the new decree eliminated publicity in court trials. There are some obvious anomalies. In the first place, many trials must already have been held without any, or any effective, public attendance. Second, the Bukharin trial, with its vast publicity, was yet to come. Still, however we take the decree, it may perhaps reflect some sort of decision by Stalin to bring public trials to an end as soon as the one then in hand was over. It is sometimes argued that the partial failure of the Bukharin trial itself led to the dropping of any further court proceedings. This decree shows that the decision may have been taken earlier. It is indeed true that the Bukharin case seems to have been giving Yazhov a good deal of trouble. While Pyatakov and Radek were ready for open court in 4 months, 9 months had already passed since Bukharin's and Rykov's arrest, and they were not to be adequately prepared for another 3 or 4 months yet. However, the plans for the Bukharin trial were now, as we shall see, reaching the stage at which all possible ingredients had been established: assassination, medical murder, industrial and agricultural sabotage, espionage, bourgeois nationalism, and treason. Each trial so far had added crimes to the roster, but after this there would be no further lesson to rub in. On 2 October came a law increasing the maximum term of imprisonment from 10 to 25 years. Tilda and a short plenum on 11 to 12 October celebrated the end of overt opposition by electing Yazhov a candidate member of the Politburo. At the same time, 24 members and candidates were expelled. This plenum also saw the fall of a prominent figure in circumstances even more high-handed than had previously been noted. The People's Commissar for Education, Andrei Bubnov, was one of the most prominent of all old Bolsheviks. He had been a delegate to the 1907 Congress, a candidate member of the Central Committee in 1912, and a member of the original Political Bureau, which existed for a short time in November 1917. With Pyatakov, he had organized the communist revolt in the Ukraine in August 1918. A democratic centralist in the early days, he had switched to Stalin's side as early as 1923, rigorously purging faction in the army, and had served loyally ever since. At the October plenum, he went with his Ukrainian opposite number as Education Commissar, Zhytomsky, to the Central Committee building, but, on showing their Central Committee membership cards, they were told by the NKVD officer on duty that they could not be admitted without further documents which had not been issued to them. Bubnov went back to his ministry and worked late. At midnight, his secretary came in trembling and told him that the radio had just announced his removal for inability to cope with his duties. The next 159 day, he handed over to the transient Tyrkin Komitilda and was arrested in 160 December. While announcements of local party trials and death sentences continued, they were now for a time rarer, and they were not given front-page treatment. The great propaganda campaign receded. The press began to fill with the preparations for elections to the Supreme Soviet. Every type of electoral article appropriate to a democracy began to appear: women voters, a powerful force, for example. And following them, the nominations of all the leaders in good order, and page after page of enthusiastic meetings all around the Union, filled the papers day after day through October. But Stalin was preparing for action against his unsatisfactory followers. A document, still in existence, was signed by Stalin, Molotov, and Kaganovich in November, to sanction the arraignment. Before a court of the military collegium of a large number of comrades from the ranks of prominent party, state and military workers. The 1961 speaker who gave this information went on to say, most of them were shot. Those innocently shot and posthumously rehabilitated include such prominent party and state figures as comrades Postishev, Kosyurp, Ik, Rudzitak and Chubar, People's Commissar of Justice Krylenko, Unschlicht, Secretary of the USSR Central Executive Committee, People's Commissar of Education Bubnov, and others. This strongly implies, though it does not actually assert, that these men were on the list referred to. Some, indeed, were already under arrest, but under the old procedure were presumably still being interrogated with the intention of any formal arraigning being postponed until the confessions had been obtained. What is more extraordinary is that some of the arrests now authorized were not carried out for weeks or months, that the accused remained in high posts for longish periods. The procedure with regard to ordinary party members seems to have been that just before an arrest, the NKVD would inform the local party committee or, in the case of important members, the Central Committee that a warrant had been issued. The member was then expelled from the party in secret session and was not informed of the expulsion until arrested. Sometimes the period between these clandestine expulsions and the arrests was quite long. A case is reported of a district party secretary in the Ukraine who was secretly expelled by the Ukrainian Central Committee in March 1938 and not arrested until July, meanwhile carrying on as usual and even expelling other members. Again, a foreign communist arrested on June 19, 1938 was shown the order for her arrest dated October 15, 1937. Needless to say, the procedure was contrary to party statutes. Who the prominent military workers referred to were has not been made explicit, but they were now falling, or about to fall, in numbers, as we have seen. The others must include the important figure of V.I. Maslauk, who now held the commissariat of heavy industry, and had since the spring been appearing on platforms with the Politburo itself. Maslauk, plumply square, balding, with glasses, was arrested in December 1937. Unschlicht, a Pole in the Dzerzhinsky tradition, had been a pro-Bolshevik member of the Polish Social Democratic Party since 1900. A member of the Petrograd Revolutionary Committee, he had served in the Civil War with Tukhachevsky, in the 16th Army, and had been wounded. He had later been vice-chairman of the All-Russian Chika. Trotsky had thought him an ambitious but talentless intriguer. By the end of the year, he too had been arrested. Meanwhile, Postyshev still held his post in Kuibyshev and was still a candidate member of the Politburo. Kosyr was still first secretary of the Ukraine and a full member of the Politburo. Chubar, vice chairman of the Council of People's Commissars and a full member of the Politburo, and the others in their relevant posts. Even Postyshev, in spite of demotion, was still not proceeded against. He is now said to have had a last conversation with Stalin, after he had been transferred to Kuibyshev, and to have frankly denounced the purge, at least as it applied to loyal party members. However, in June, he had been given reasonable headlines for his speech to the party conference in his new fief at Kuibyshev. It was a call, extreme even by the standards then prevailing, for the vigilant uprooting of Trotskyites. Eek, a large, serious-looking man, smooth-mustached, with a reputation for ruthlessness, a party member since 1905, was made People's Commissar for Agriculture in Chernov's place on 30 October. In the West Siberian territory, which had hitherto been his satrapy, Vyshinsky had alleged an inadequate number of prosecutions for counter-revolutionary activity in 1937, a fact which may well have been due to weak attitude or at least have figured in the later charges against him. On November 3, 1937, a poster for the Republican elections, consisting of portraits of the Politburo, was put out. It contained all the full members, including Kosyr and Chubar, but of the candidate members only Zhdanov and Yazhov were shown. Ailke, Postyshev, and Petrovsky were thus demonstratively snubbed. In fact, throughout this period, signs of degradation were visited on the candidate members of the Politburo who were later to fall. They were omitted from honorary presidiums. Large numbers of lists of nominations for the December election of the Supreme Soviet starting in late October usually left them out, and often omitted Kosyr too. But they were included in the conventional letter of important figures refusing multiple nomination on instructions of the Central Committee. And all, Kosyr, Postyshev, Eek, Chubar, and Petrovsky, were returned in the elections which followed. For the best part of 2 months, until the actual voting of 12 December and afterward, these elections were given intense prominence and publicity. Every day, articles, photographs, lists of places where Politburo members would speak, the addresses of meetings to their candidates, and a vast apparatus of joyful expectancy reigned on paper. Mass resolutions were printed under such headings as "With Joy We Vote for Nikolai Ivanovich Yazhov," poems, such as one by Stalin's Kazakh Akbar Jambul, People's Commissar Yazhov, gave a view of the police chief which would have been thought excessively rosy if applied to a ruler like good King Wenceslas. Throughout December, articles and statements on the elections continued to appear. There were many reports from abroad of, for example, the great impression made in England. And so the days drew on. As the election publicity gradually petered out, there were other themes for the public, for example, the centenary of the Georgian poet Rustavelli, eked out with much Stakhanovite conferencing. But the year was not to end without a demonstrative killing. Only 5 months had separated the Zinoviev and Pyatakov trials. Since then, 11 had passed, and the Bukharin case was still not ready. As an interim measure, a group of men who were not prepared to confess was tried in camera under the 14th of September law. On December 20, 1937 the papers ran page after page to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Vsheka, OGPU and KVD, with pictures of Dzerzhinsky and Yazhov. That body's vigilance had been demonstrated the previous day by the announcement of a purge in the bread distribution organizations. Workers' meetings sent applause, and poems about the splendid role of the secret police appeared in profusion. Pravda carried a long article by Frinovsky, and also a long list of awards, including the Order of Lenin to Boris Berman. Among this feast of laudatory generalization, a short announcement drew attention to the more practical side of the work of Yazhov's men. It said that on 16 December, Yanukitsa, with Karaldian, Shabultayev, Oral Dilashvili, and others, had been tried before the military collegium of the Supreme Court as spies, bourgeois nationalists, and terrorists, had confessed, and had been executed. In the Bukharin trial, Yanukitsa was to be made the central villain of terrorist activity, held responsible for the organization of the murder of Kirov, and said to have instructed Yagoda to tell Zaporozhyes not to hinder the act. He was also to be responsible for plotting the murder of Gorky. Orakalashvili, who had been secretary of the Georgian Central Committee, had for the past 5 years acted as deputy director of the Marx-Engels-Lenin Institute in Moscow. He is now said to have lost his life. As a result of objecting to Beria's book on the Bolshevik movement in the Caucasus, which was heavily ficked to give Stalin a major role. Although the charges and the supposed confessions did not impress, there seemed no reason to doubt that such a trial had indeed taken place as stated. It was only in the 1960s that death dates given for the accused made it clear that the whole thing was a complete lie. Kara Khan had been shot on 20th of September, with several others, including I.A.T. Adorovich, head of the Society of Former Political Prisoners, Yanukidze and Shaboltaev had perished on 30th of October, with other leading figures, including 13 other full members of the Central Committee, such as Chudov, Godotsky, Rumyantsev, Katayevich, and Lobov. Shaboltaev's wife, Lika, a niece of Rudzutak, was severely interrogated, with threats to her newborn baby, and is reported going mad. Nazaridian was also shot on 30th of October. His wife, Klavia, with her 7-year-old son and 5-year-old daughter, were taken to a special prison for women and children, a former church. Later they were sent to camp, but the daughter was eventually retrieved by a brave aunt. Klavia was apparently sentenced to 8 years, released in 1946, rearrested, but survived to be rehabilitated. Orkalashvili, indeed, had been executed on 11th of December, only 5 days before his supposed trial. He was not even tried by the Supreme Court, as stated, but by a troika of the Georgian NKVD. His wife had been shot on 17th of September. At any rate, none of the supposed leading defendants at the trial of 16th of December were in fact alive when it took place. Why Stalin played this elaborate farce is unknown. Another massacre of the 30th of October type had taken place on 26-27 November. N.S. Komarov was then shot, as was Iakov Viring, former secretary of the Bolshevik faction in the Duma, Y.S. Hanetsky, who had secured Lenin's release from Austrian jail. His daughter was also arrested, 7N.A. Kubayak, former secretary of the Central Committee, D.E. Solimov, Nosov, and at least 14 other important figures, including M.M. Nemtsov, secretary of the Society of Old Bolsheviks. On 21 December, there was a grand ceremonial meeting for the NKVD in the Bolshoi Theater in the presence of Kaganovich, Molotov, Voroshilov, Mikoyan, and Khrushchev. The whole of the full membership of the Politburo, including Kosyur and Chubar, who were not present, were elected to the honorary presidium, but only Zhdanov and Yazhov among the candidate members, the remaining places being taken by Khrushchev and Bulganyan. Mikoyan was the main speaker, lavishing praise on Yazhov as a talented faithful pupil of Stalin, beloved by the Soviet people, and as having achieved the greatest victory in the history of the party, a victory we will never forget, he concluded, learn the Stalinist style of work from Comrade Yazhov, as he learned it from Comrade Stalin. In January came an important plenum of the Central Committee and the presentation of a new government to the Supreme Soviet. The positions of Postyshev and Kosyur were affected. In Kuibyshev province, Postyshev had tried to make up for his earlier opposition to the purges by extremely harsh action. He was now accused of excesses in this line. Malenkov, reporting, accused him of by cries of vigilance hiding his brutality in connection with the party. When Postyshev replied that almost all the secretaries of district committees and executive committees were in fact hostile elements, Molotov, Mikoyan, and Bulganyan accused him of exaggerating. Kaganovich brought up his supposedly similar errors in Kiev the previous year. Komatilda and Malenkov summed up that his acts, and refusal to admit them, were an obvious provocation. Malenkov was not even a candidate member of the committee. Only 28 of the 71 full members elected 4 years earlier were now in fact available to constitute the plenum. Registered. Postyshev, still described as comrade, was replaced as candidate member of the Politburo by Khrushchev. This was the last occasion on which a removal from Politburo was officially announced. Henceforth, names simply disappeared from lists and photographs. Pravda's leader of the same day denounced the heads of certain party organizations, giving that of Kuibyshev as an example, for having around them sworn enemies of the people, while expelling honest elements. The Central Committee resolution menacingly noted that the NKVD had had to intervene to save slandered party members expelled in the province. Postyshev had also in fact received a confidential party censure while in Kuibyshev for protecting enemies of the people. Stalin had now suggested that Postyshev might be removed from the Politburo, remaining a member of the Central Committee, and this was voted unanimously. However, his case was referred to the Control Commission, which reported that he had known of and worked with the right, Trotskyite organization, and he was expelled from the party. But he was not arrested for a few days. He had a small flat in Moscow, where he was visited after this by his fighter pilot son. There he seems to have remained until his arrest on 21 February. Kosyur, in Kiev among the crumbled remnants of his power, had had a bad year. His brother I.V. Kossier, also a member of the Central Committee, had died in apparent good odor on 3 July, though it was later revealed that his death was, in reality, a suicide-like Orjonikidze's. Another brother, V. Kossier, an old oppositionist, had been given 10 years in 1934 and been implicated again in the Pyatakov trial. During the summer, he had been one of a batch of oppositionists brought from Vorkuta to Moscow and shot. Kossier and Petrovsky went to Kiev on January 26, 1938 and were welcomed at the station by the supposititious Ukrainian Central Committee. On 27 January, its plenum released Kossier from his 188 post. The first secretaryship of the Ukraine was transferred, as we have seen, to the coming man, Nikita Khrushchev. But far from falling into immediate oblivion, Kossier was appointed instead vice chairman of the USSR Council of People's Commissars and president of the Soviet Control Commission. In fact, the new government presented by Molotov to the Supreme Soviet on January 19, 1938 had as its three vice premiers S.V. Kossier, Chubar, and Mikoyan, while Ik was People's Commissar for Agriculture. The vice chairman of the Council of People's Commissars cannot indeed seriously have thought of themselves as holding powerful positions. Both Voroshilov and Kaganovich, in charge of important departments and invariably ranking senior to them in party listings, were not at this time vice premiers, an adequate demonstration of the post's comparatively decorative significance. Even so, we have the extraordinary spectacle of Molotov taking the chair at a meeting of the Council of People's Commissars, the official order for the trial and arrest of several of whose members he had already signed. At meetings of Molotov and the vice premiers, two out of the three supposedly contributing to policy discussions were actually no more than dead men talking, whose opinions were by now quite meaningless. During the Khrushchev period, it was customary to speak of the January 1938 plenum as marking a return to legality, it being thought suitable for such a turn of events to mark Khrushchev's promotion to the highest levels. Indeed, the resolution of the plenum as ever speaks strongly against unjust expulsions from the party, and this, with the attacks on provincial committees for the same error, which were to continue throughout the year, gave that impression to those who wished to receive it. But there was no sign of any real improvement. A Soviet account given in April 1964 managed to satisfy the demands both of Khrushchev and of truth by saying, "The January 1938 plenum of the Central Committee of the All-Union Communist Party somewhat improved the situation. However, repressions did not cease." Equals. It was Yuzhnov himself who made some of the most critical remarks about the wickedness of expelling members wrongly. Throughout the terror, the leadership had constantly spoken against unfair expulsions, with the aim, however, of destroying its subordinates. For example, as we have seen, in the 1937 attack on Postyshev, the real motive of which was to remove an objection to the terror, the official line was condemnation of inadequate party democracy. In fact, this can be traced even in the Central Committee's key letter of the summer of 1936, which spoke strongly against unprincipled expulsions. The January 1938 resolution criticizes a large number of local party organizations in addition to that of Kuibyshev for such practices, blaming officials such as the former secretary of the Kiev Provincial Committee of the Communist Party of the Ukraine, the enemy of the people Kudryavzhev, the exposed enemy of the people Shatsky, head of the leading party organs administration of the Rostov Provincial Committee, and so on, and telling pathetic tales of honest Bolsheviks, and even their relatives by marriage, who had lost their jobs as a result of incorrect denunciation. The persistence of this theme is remarkable. Clearly, it was a great advantage to blame Postyshev and others for inhumanity rather than for belated humanity. In this way, the central leadership could, or might think it could, avoid some of the unpopularity arising from its own actions. But we might perhaps go further and see in this a sign that Stalin, right from the start, had determined to put the odium on his instruments and to destroy them when their task was completed. If so, he was to some degree successful. The Yezhovshchina remained the popular name for the reign of terror, and with the disappearance of Yuzhnov himself, some of the curse was taken off the surviving leadership. On 9 and February 10, 1938, as if to mark the continuity of the purge, a fresh group of 14 or 15 significant figures perished. They included A.P. Smirnov, Kaminsky, and Mukhlevich. M. I. Urbanov, first secretary of the Buryat Mongolistr, was among them. Purged with him was his second secretary, A. Markazov. Markazov's daughter, Jelia, was in a famous photograph taken in 1936 in which she is held in Stalin's arms, which indicated his love of children, and it continued to appear after he had orphaned her. In fact, a sculpture modeled on the photograph was set up in the Stalinskaya metro station. Meanwhile, Arrests and denunciations continued. N. V. Krylenko, now serving as People's Commissar for Justice, was attacked in January at the first meeting of the Supreme Soviet, for neglecting his duties in favor of mountain climbing and chess, and was not reappointed. When he had handed over, to Ulrich's subordinate, N. M. Rychkov, Stalin personally telephoned him to reassure him about future work. He was, of course, on the list of those to be arrested, and was in fact arrested the same night, January 31, 1938, with some of his family. Krylenko, whom Lenin had appointed commander-in-chief of the army immediately after the revolution, had impressed Bruce Lockhart in 1918 as an epileptic degenerate and is referred to in 1938 by a fellow prisoner as notorious and universally despised. He had conducted the prosecution in such fake trials as the Shokta case and the Menshevik trial. As to his other interests, he had shown farcical dogmatism at a Congress of Chess Players in 1932. We must finish once and for all with the neutrality of chess. We must condemn once and for all the formula chess for the sake of chess, like the formula art for art's sake. We must organize shock brigades of chess players, and begin immediate realization of a five-year plan for chess. On his arrest, he is reported being treated with special indignity in the Butyrka to take the conceit out of him. But he was soon taken to the Lefortovo for serious interrogation. The original charge was of connections with the Bukharin conspiracy, and the creation of a wrecking organization in the Commissariat of Justice, in which he had personally enlisted 30 people. On 3 March, he confessed that he had belonged to an anti-Soviet organization since 1930. But by 3 April, this was put further back, and he was confessing to having worked against Lenin before the revolution and having plotted with Bukharin, Pyatakov, and Preobrazhensky after it. In general, secret executions of prominent committee members already arrested, and arrests of many of those still at large, continued. The party, as it had existed a year previously, had been broken. From district secretaries to people's commissars, the veterans of Stalin's first period of rule had fallen to Yazhov's assault. But further blows were being prepared for the terrified survivors. Nations in torment. Of all the treasures a state can possess, the human lives of its citizens are for us the most precious. Stalin. It is very hard for the Western reader to envision the sufferings of the Soviet people as a whole during the 1930s. And in considering the terror, it is precisely this moral and intellectual effort which must be made. To demonstrate the facts is to provide the bare framework of evidence. It is not the province of the investigator to do more. Yet it cannot but be that these facts are offered for moral judgment. And however coolly we consider them, we should think in terms of Pasternak, breaking off his sketch for an autobiography before the terror with the words "to continue" it would be immeasurably difficult. One would have to talk in a manner which would grip the heart and make the hair stand on end. Thus far we have dealt with the purge as it struck the party. Information about this side of it, especially from Soviet sources, is much richer than for the larger but less dramatic fate of the ordinary Soviet citizen. Yet for every party member who suffered, and many of them were scarcely political in any real sense, six or seven others went to the cells. The figures we have so far been covering were consciously involved to a greater or lesser degree in a political struggle whose rules they understood. They had themselves in many cases been responsible for the imprisonment or death of peasants and others by the million in the course of collectivization. Our pity for their own sufferings should doubtless not be withheld, but it can at least be qualified by a sense of their having a lesser claim to sympathy than the ordinary citizen of the country. If Krylenko was to go to the execution cellars, he had sent to their deaths, on false charges, hundreds of others. If Trotsky was to be assassinated in exile, he had ordered the shooting of thousands of the rank and file, and gloried in it. Pushkin once described an earlier generation of Russian revolutionaries as positively heartless men who care little for their own skins, and still less for those of others. We may accept this about such people as Rosengoltz. But it plainly does not apply to his wife. In her, we can already see the fate and the feelings of an ordinary non-communist, caught up in the frightful tensions and agonies of the Great Purge. The oppressive feeling that hung over everything is well illustrated by a comparison made by Dudorov, in Dr. Zhivago. It isn't only in comparison with your life as a convict, but compared to everything in the 30s, even to my favorable conditions at the university, in the midst of books and money and comfort, even to me there, the war came as a breath of fresh air, an omen of deliverance, a purifying storm. And when the war broke out, its real horrors, its real dangers, its menace of real death, were a blessing compared to the inhuman power of the lie. It is difficult for those of us who have lived in fairly stable societies to make the imaginative effort of realizing that the heads of the great state can be men who in the ordinary course of events would be thought of as criminals. It is almost equally hard to get the feeling of life under the Great Terror. It is easy to speak of the constant fear of the 4 o'clock a.m. knock on the door, of the hunger, fatigue, and hopelessness of the great labor camps. But to feel how this was worse than a particularly frightful war is not so simple. Russia had undergone terror before. Lenin had spoken of it frankly as an instrument of policy. During the Civil War period, executions simply of class enemies were carried out on a large scale. But the circumstances were different in many ways. In those days, it was, as it were, a hot terror. Injustices and brutalities were perpetrated throughout the country, but they were seldom part of a big planned operation from above. And they were openly described in their true colors. Those were indeed terrible days, when the Chukoskwads were shooting class hostages in scores and hundreds. Those who went through them might have thought that nothing could be worse. But Lenin's terror was the product of the years of war and violence, of the collapse of society and administration, of the desperate acts of rulers precariously riding the flood, and fighting for control and survival. Stalin, on the contrary, attained complete control at a time when general conditions were calm. By the end of the 1920s, the country had, however reluctantly, accepted the existence and stability of the Soviet government. And that government had, in turn, made slight economic and other concessions which had led to comparative prosperity. It was in cold blood, quite deliberately and unprovokedly, that Stalin started a new cycle of suffering. First had come the party's war on the peasantry. When this had done its worst and things were settling down again in the mid-1930s, the Great Terror was again launched cold-bloodedly at a helpless population. And the cold-bloodedness was compounded by the other distinguishing quality of the Stalin purge, the total falsehood of all the reasons given for it and accusations made during it. There was another factor. In the First World War, as Robert Graves notes in Goodbye to All That, a soldier could stand the squalor and danger of the trenches only for a certain time. After that, the wear and tear became too great. After the first month, under the tensions of trench life, an officer began to deteriorate a little. At 6 months, he was still more or less all right, but by 9 or 10 months, he became a drag on the other officers. After a year or 15 months, he was often worse than useless. Graves notes that over the age of about 33, and particularly over 40, men had less resistance. Officers who had done 2 years or more often became dipsomaniacs. Men went about their tasks in an apathetic and doped condition, cheated into further endurance. It had taken Graves himself, he says, some 10 years to recover. He adds that none of this was due simply to physical conditions. In a good battalion, physical illness was rare. What is so hard to convey about the feeling of Soviet citizens in 1936 to 1938 is the similar long-drawn-out sweat of fear, night after night, that the moment of arrest might arrive before the next dawn. The comparison is reasonable even as to the casualty figures. The risk was a big enough one to be constantly present. And again, while under other dictatorships arrests have been selective, falling on genuinely suspected enemies of the regime, in the Azov era, just as in the mudholes of Verdun and Ypres, anyone at all could feel that he might be the next victim. The whole people were the victim, including those who were not directly affected by the repressions. Even those who had not had a family member, relative, or friend suffer. True, there were not all that many of them, even they experienced the fear and all sorts of burdens and, in general, to put it mildly, had by no means an easy time of things, the exceptions to this general rule were relatively insignificant in number. And the public trials, as another Soviet periodical points out, everywhere created an atmosphere of total suspicion and fear. Fear by night, and a feverish effort by day to pretend enthusiasm for a system of lies, was the permanent condition of the Soviet citizen. Denunciation. For Stalin required not only submission, but also complicity. The moral crisis arose in a form well described by Pasternak. In 1937, he later told Dr. Nielsen, "On one occasion they came to me, with something they wanted me to sign. It was to the effect that I approved of the party's execution of the generals. In a sense this was a proof of their confidence in me. They didn't go to those who were on the list for liquidation. My wife was pregnant. She cried and begged me to sign, but I couldn't. That day I examined the pros and cons of my own survival. I was convinced that I would be arrested, my turn had now come. I was prepared for it. I abhorred all this blood. I couldn't stand things any longer. But nothing happened. It was, I was told later, my colleagues who saved me indirectly. No one dared to report to the hierarchy that I hadn't signed. But few could match the moral grandeur of the great poet. Everyone was isolated. The individual, silently objecting, was faced with vast meetings calling for the death like dogs of the opposition leaders, or approving the slaughter of the generals. How could he know if they were not genuine, or largely so? There was no sign of opposition or even neutrality, enthusiasm was the only visible phenomenon. Even the children and relatives of the arrested got up to denounce their parents. The disintegration of family loyalty was a conscious Stalinist aim. When, in November 1938, Stalin destroyed the leadership of the Komsomol, headed by Kosarev, his complaint was that the organization was not devoting itself to vigilance activities, but sticking to its statutory obligation as a political training ground for young communists. Stalin's idea of a good young communist demanded not this sort of political training, but the qualities of an enthusiastic young narc. Many denunciations were made out of fear. If someone heard an incautious word, and failed to report it, it might be he who would suffer. There are many accounts of party members, unable to think of any enemies of the people among their acquaintances, being severely censured by their own branch secretaries as lacking in revolutionary vigilance. There are many stories of conversations between old acquaintances which became too frank and ended with each of them denouncing the other. Any conversation that strayed even slightly from the orthodox could only be conducted between old and trusted friends, and with great circumspection. Ilya Ehrenberg's daughter had an old shaggy poodle which had learned the trick of closing the dining room door as soon as the guests began to talk in a guarded way. As it was given a slice of sausage for its vigilance, it became expert at guessing the type of conversation. Not every responsible citizen did his duty as a delator. One director gave a lift to the mother of an enemy of the people, an old woman, and was told by his chauffeur, "Comrade director, I may be a son of a bitch who must report everything he sees and hears. Believe me or not, but I swear by my own mother that I will not report this time. My own mother is just a plain woman, not a fine lady like this one. But I love her and, anyhow, thank you, Viktor Andreyevich," as one Russian to another. And in fact this incident was never brought up against the director, though many less serious crimes were to be alleged against him. Nevertheless, just as Nazism provided an institutionalized outlet for the sadist, so Stalinist totalitarianism on the whole automatically encouraged the mean and malicious. The carriers of personal or office feuds, the poison pen letter writers, who are a minor nuisance in any society, flourished and increased. "I have seen," says Ehrenberg, "how in a progressive society people allegedly dedicated to moral ideas committed dishonorable acts for personal advantage, betrayed comrades and friends, how wives disavowed their husbands and resourceful sons heaped abuse upon hapless fathers." A Soviet story of the Khrushchev period tells, as reasonably typical, of a geology student who denounced another because he heard him, at a dance, telling his girlfriend that his father had been executed, a fact that he had failed to disclose at the institute. After the first student reported it, his colleague disappeared, to serve 15 years in a labor camp. Individual denouncers operated on an extraordinary scale. In one district in Kiev, 69 persons were denounced by one man, in another, over 100. Degree in Odessa, a single communist denounced 230 people. In Poltava, a party member denounced his entire organization. At the 18th Party Congress, when the excesses of the purge period were being belatedly and peripherally criticized, one was now made to confess his methods, which had involved removing 15 local party secretaries. Another well-known slanderer, in Kiev, applied for a free pass to a resort on the grounds that he had worn out his strength in the struggle with the enemy, a remark which caused loud laughter at the Congress. Extraordinary results came from purely lunatic denunciations. Many poison pen letters were mere malignant fantasy. There were odder cases yet, such as the Red Army deserter Silikov, who gave himself up in Kiev with a dramatic tale of an anti-Soviet plot in which he played the leading part. His original story was of planning an armed raid on a post office to provide funds for a terrorist organization, but of having decided instead to throw himself on the mercy of Soviet justice. This was not much use to the NKVD. After Silikov had been badly kicked and beaten, a quite different version was worked out, involving not him and a few vague friends, but his military unit. The leader of the plot was now not Silikov, but his commanding officer. They had planned terroristic attacks on government leaders. Almost the whole unit, from the CO to the drivers, were arrested, with many of their wives. Silikov's two sisters, both working girls, his old and crippled mother, and his father were all pulled in too. So was an uncle who had only met his nephew once and who, having served as a corporal in the old army, was transmuted into a Tsarist general. This absurd case proliferated fantastically until there was not a single cell in Kiev prison which did not contain someone involved in the Silikov plot. Equals when Yazhov and his latest representative in Kiev, Yaspinsky, fell late in 1938, Silikov and his fellow accused were reinterrogated with a view to getting them to withdraw their confessions. Some of them, fearing a trick, refused, and had to be given tough treatment once again, to force them to withdraw false confessions involving them in crimes carrying the death penalty. Silikov himself was finally sentenced to 3 years imprisonment for denunciation only. But the NKVD did not, of course, leave denunciation on an amateur and voluntary basis. Everywhere it organized a special network, the Sexsots, recruited from among the general population. Sexsots were divided into two types, the voluntary, malicious degenerates out to injure their neighbors, together with idealists who were convinced that they were working for the cause, and the involuntary, who were drawn into it out of fear, or, very often, promises of the alleviation of the fate of an arrested member of the prospective Sexsot's family. These last hoped that if they kept strictly to the truth and reported nothing disadvantageous about their friends, no harm would be done. But once started, they were trapped, the pressure became greater and greater. The Sexsot who failed to produce information was himself automatically suspect. As the population became more and more careful in its talk, more and more harmless acts and words had to be reported, misinterpreted, and finally invented to slake the NKVD's insatiable appetite for plots. One Ukrainian Sexsot is described as having become a genuine convert to communism, though unable to join the party owing to former White Army connections, and therefore wishing to serve the cause in the one way which appeared to be open to him. At first, he abused no confidences and reported impartially. He was only doing his duty, and doing one's duty is always pleasurable. When he had occasionally to overcome his own scruples or likes and dislikes in carrying it out, he felt a positive hero. But naturally, simple hints of feelings hostile to the government were not in themselves sufficient, for the NKVD of course knew that such could be found in a large section of the population. He put up a struggle, but was himself threatened as having concealed evidence. Gradually going to pieces, he started first to interpret remarks, until slowly the distinction between truth and falsehood faded out in his mind. Even so, he failed to give satisfaction because he retained a sense of the plausible, and his inventions were too limited for his superiors, so he was himself arrested. The Soviet press had recently published material from the archives about informers, for example, a letter from one who was by now himself a prisoner, claiming clemency because of his earlier services in denouncing Varakis and a number of others, including writers and actors, and after his own arrest, numerous fellow prisoners. In some areas, bounties were paid for denunciation. In one Belarusian village depicted in a recent Soviet article, 15 rubles a head was paid, and a group of regular denouncers used to carouse on the proceeds, even singing a song they had composed to celebrate their deeds. Every account of life in a Soviet office or institution, even before the Great Purge, is replete with intrigues. Such, doubtless, would be true of most other countries. But the resources available to a keen intriguer in Soviet conditions made it a far greater menace, since the normal method of getting on was to compromise and have expelled from the party, and as often as not arrested, either one's rival or, if his position was for the time being too strong, one of his subordinates, through whom he could eventually be undermined. One rough estimate was that every fifth person in the average office was in one way or another an NKVD stool pigeon. Weisberg speaks of the foundry industry, with which he had connections through experiments to improve blast furnaces. Following Vakaria, Orjonikidze's nephew and one of the geniuses of the industrialization drive, all the directors of the big foundries in the Ukraine were arrested. A few months later their successors were arrested too. It was only the third or fourth batch who managed to keep their seats. In this way the direction of the foundry industry came into the hands of young and inexperienced men. They had not even the normal advantages of youth in their favor, for the choosing had been a very negative one. They were the men who had denounced others on innumerable occasions. They had bowed the knee whenever they had come up against higher authority. They were morally and intellectually crippled. And, of course, this applied not only to industry, but to the whole of the new ruling cadre. As a Soviet periodical complained in 1988, it was the conscious result of negative selection, of the horrible social selection which went on in this country for decades. Right through the purge, Stalin's blows were struck at every form of solidarity and comradeship outside of that provided by personal allegiance to himself. In general, the terror destroyed personal confidence between private citizens everywhere. The heaviest impact of all was, of course, on the institutional and communal loyalties which still existed in the country after 18 years of one-party rule. The most powerful and important organization drawing loyalty to itself and its ideas rather than to the general secretary himself was the party, or rather its pre-Stalinist membership. Then came the army. Then the intellectual class, rightly seen as the potential bearer of heretical attitudes. These special allegiances attracted particularly violent attention. But in proceeding to attack the entire people on the same basis, Stalin was being perfectly logical. The atomization of society, the destruction of all trust and loyalty except to him and his agents, could only be carried out by such methods. In fact, the stage was reached which the writer Isaac Babel summed up: today a man only talks freely with his wife, at night, with the blankets pulled over his head. Only the very closest of friends could hint to one another of their disbelief of official views, and often not even then. The ordinary citizen had no means of discovering how far the official lies were accepted. He might be one of a scattered and helpless minority, and Stalin might have won his battle to destroy the idea of the truth in the Soviet mind. Millions led double lives, as the grandson of the executed army commander Yakir was to write later. Every man became in one sense what Dunn says he is not, an island. Not that everyone blamed Stalin. His skill in remaining in the background deceived even minds like Pasternak and Meyerhold. If men, albeit non-political, of this caliber could feel so, it is clear that the idea must have been widespread. The fear and hatred of the population was concentrated on Yezhov, who was thus unconsciously making himself ready to be the scapegoat, the eponym of the Yezhovshchina. Mass terror. As the number of arrests based on charges of counter-revolutionary crimes grew tenfold between 1936 and 1937, tilde the purge extended itself outward from the party victims to include all their contacts, however slight. For example, in 1932 the party secretary of the Urals, Kabakov, had visited some workers' quarters and chanced to look in at an apartment where he found only the mother at home. She told him that her son had gone on a rest cure after being overworked, but had to do it at his own expense. Kabakov ordered the management of the trust employing the worker to pay the expenses. 5 years later, when Kabakov was arrested, see here, someone informed the NKVD that he had visited this worker and given him protection. The worker was himself at once pulled in, and accused of bootlicking Kabakov. 13 accomplices had been found for Nikolaev, who had really acted alone. This became a general principle. Vigilance was made the test of a good citizen or employee, as well as of a good party member. The NKVD everywhere, and all public organizations and economic institutions, were under continual pressure to show their worth in uprooting the enemy. Every man arrested was pressed to denounce accomplices, and in any case all his acquaintances automatically became suspects. In the show trials themselves, some of the confessions automatically implicated not just individual or groups of political associates, but also wide circles completely outside the party struggle. For example, in his evidence in the Bukharin Trio 1, Zelensky pleaded guilty to the fact that 15% of the staff of the Central Cooperative Union consisted of former Mensheviks, socialist revolutionaries, anarchists, Trotskyites, etc. In certain regions the number of alien elements, former members of other parties, Kolchak officers and so on, was considerably higher. These elements were, he said, assembled to act as a center of attraction for all kinds of anti-Soviet elements. The way this would snowball almost automatically, and throughout the country, is obvious. Yet it was not only this process of association that gave the purge its increasingly mass character. In the 1930s, there were still hundreds of thousands who had been members of non-Bolshevik parties, the masses who had served in white armies, professional men who had been abroad, nationalist elements in the local intelligentsias, and so on. The increasingly virulent campaign for vigilance against the hidden enemy blanketed the whole country, not merely the party, in a press and radio campaign. And while the destruction of hostile elements in the party was going forward, it must have seemed natural to use the occasion to break all remaining elements suspected of not being reconciled to the regime. For this sizable part of the population was already listed in the files of the NKVD and its local branches under various headings, such as anti-Soviet element D's active member of the Church S member of a religious sect. Rebel, anyone who in the past was in any way involved in anti-Soviet uprisings. SI anyone with contacts abroad. Such categories were not in themselves legal grounds for prosecution, but they automatically made those listed natural suspects and almost automatic victims when an NKVD branch was called upon to show its merits by mass arrests. We have a more detailed division of these suspect categories in the lists of dangerous elements issued on the annexation of Lithuania by the USSR in 1940.7. Since even by January 1941, after half a year's occupation, there were admittedly only 2,500 communists in the country. Few of the worst suspects, real Trotskyites, could be found. And no threat to Stalin's position as a whole could come from so small a territory. But in the selection of those whose elimination was required to turn the country into a more or less reliable fief, we can see some of the way of thinking which had been applied to Russia itself. The lists itemized all former officials of the state, army, and judiciary, all former members of non-communist parties, all active members of student corporations, members of the National Guard, anyone who fought against the Soviets, that is, in 1918 to 1920, refugees, representatives of foreign firms, employees and former employees of foreign legations, firms, and companies, people in contact with foreign countries, including philatelists and Esperantists, all clergy, former noblemen, landlords, merchants, bankers, businessmen, owners of hotels and restaurants, and shopkeepers, and former Red Cross officials. It is estimated that these people covered about 23% of the population. In the Soviet Union, many in these categories had already died or emigrated. But many were left. And around each was a widening circle of colleagues and acquaintances who automatically entered the field of suspicion by association with alien elements. Anyone in a job worked under a state official who might turn out to be a Trotskyite. Anyone, anywhere, might find that he bought his groceries from a former kulak or was neighbor to an Armenian bourgeois nationalist. Thus in Nikopol, when the party secretary fell, the NKVD arrested his assistants, his friends, the men and women whom he had put into jobs anywhere in Nikopol. The commandant of the Nikopol garrison went into the hunter's bag, then the local prosecutor and all his legal staff, finally the chairman of the Nikopol Soviet, the local bank, the newspaper, all commercial institutions were cleansed, the manager of the communal administration, the chief of the fire brigades, the head of the savings institution. Crowds of women and children swarmed around the NKVD building in Nikopol at all hours, in spite of the bitter cold. A recent Soviet comment on the purges is that, as against the argument, sometimes met, that the purges were largely confined to party officials, they hit everyone: doctors, intellectuals, peasants, atheists, priests, industrial managers, diplomats, former private businessmen. In the Butyrka, Eugenia Ginsburg's cellmates were, as she puts it, a much broader section of the population than in the special block in Kazan. There were many peasants, factory workers, shopgirls, office clerks. Roy Medvedev, again, mentions about 1,000 arrested in a single factory. In fact, as the Soviet trade union organ Trud recently put it, it is a myth that the working class was not touched by the repressions, for statistics show that millions of all sections of the population suffered. In Moldavia, an absolute majority of the repressed were workers and peasants, often semi-literate or illiterate, with no interest in politics. Figures given in the Soviet press for Kursk province imply that about 20% of the arrests were in the countryside, that is, for the USSR as a whole, about 1.5 million. A recent Soviet article describes how in the writer's home village of 100 households, one day in April 1937, two policemen arrived, stopped the farm work, and arrested all the men between 20 and 50 years old, on charges of having started the sowing too late for sabotage reasons. Numbering 65 in all, they were taken off in lorries, the writer's father among them. In 1956, the writer learned that his father had not survived. Trademark. Thus, while officialdom, the intelligentsia, and the officer corps were prime victims, by mid-1937 practically the entire population was potential purge fodder. Few can have failed to wonder if their turn had come. Pasternak, in the bitterly matter-of-fact passage with which he ends the main body of Dr. Zhivago, gives the expectations of the time. One day Lara went out and did not come back. She must have been arrested on the street, as so often happened in those days, and she died or vanished somewhere, forgotten as a nameless number on a list which later was mislaid, in one of the innumerable mixed or women's concentration camps in the north. Russians who had been abroad and came back toward the autumn of 1937, like Ilya Ehrenberg, were deeply shocked by the change. Even on his way through from Spain, when he rang his daughter from Paris, he could get nothing out of her except conversation about the weather. In Moscow itself, he found that writer after writer and journalist after journalist had disappeared. In the Izvestia office, they had given up putting nameplates outside the doors of department heads, as the messenger girl explained, here today and gone tomorrow. In the ministries and the offices, it was everywhere the same: empty seats, haggard faces, and an extreme unwillingness to talk. An American journalist living in a block of about 160 apartments in the summer of 1937 notes that the secret police had made arrests in more than half of them, and our house was no exception. There were various methods of avoiding arrest. A well-known scholar avoided the first wave of the purge by pretending to be a drunkard. Another, taking the same line a little further, got drunk and created a disturbance in a public park, thus getting 6 months for a minor criminal offense and avoiding political trouble. By a curious irony, some genuine enemies of the regime, perhaps more prescient than most, escaped by simply fading into the background. For example, Nicholas Stashuk, who had actually been Minister of Supply in the anti-communist Rada government in the Ukraine in 1918, survived in Mariupol working as a park attendant until the German occupation during the Second World War, when he became a leading figure in the nationalist movement in the area. There was sometimes a period between disgrace and arrest which a lucky individual might make use of by leaving the main centers. S.G. Poplawski, who was to be installed by Stalin as deputy commander-in-chief of the Polish army after the war, was at the Frunze Military Academy in 1937. Expelled from the party and the academy, he at once left Moscow to avoid the next step. A year or a year and a half later, that is, presumably after the fall of Azov, he reappeared and was then rehabilitated and readmitted to the course. Again. The editor of the Kazan newspaper, Kuznetsov, who was to figure in my charge sheet as belonging to the same underground group, disappeared into the wilds of Kazakhstan and was never arrested because they lost track of him and eventually stopped looking. Later he even had his translations of Kazakh odes to Stalin the Great and Father Yazhov published in Pravda. In general, moving frequently was a certain protection, since it usually took at least 6 months or a year before the local NKVD paid much attention or accumulated enough evidence against a figure whom there was no exceptional reason to persecute. It also took a great deal of time before his personal documents from the NKVD of his previous place of residence were forwarded, particularly as all such documents were dispatched by special NKVD express messenger and not through the ordinary post. Sometimes they never arrived at all. Siberia, in particular, was a good place to go. Comparatively speaking, the local authorities were glad to have settlers, hardly distinguishing between people in forced exile and those freely arriving. The NKVD in a province in European Russia would have little interest in providing suspects for its Siberian opposite number, and though it could have a man under suspicion brought back, this was troublesome and hardly worth going through, except in important cases. But moving was an option open to few, and was often no more than temporary protection. The arrests came, eventually, in millions. Vyshinsky's assistant, Rajinsky, who got a 15-year sentence, continued to argue in camp that the regime was justified in isolating from the community large numbers of people who might cause trouble and in continuing to exploit to the maximum, regardless of any guilt or innocence, the labor of those who were economically old and useless. More sophisticated NKVD and party members would defend the purges on subtler grounds. Even if mild jokes or criticism of the government was all that had taken place, this was a potential for future active opposition, and the NKVD, by excising such people, was carrying out a justified preventive operation. In the factories, public denunciation meetings of the established type spread to the workers as a whole. A Soviet novel of the Khrushchev period typically describes such a work scene in 1937. A short man in a lambskin cap angrily announced, "My foreman Sereda failed to issue me with cement. I thought at the time this was suspicious. Yesterday I learned that Sereda was concealing his relationship with one of Makhno's followers who married his cousin. The Fitterzverkin, when taking up employment, concealed the fact that his old man was an elder of the church," announced a second speaker. A third speaker proceeded to expose his former comrade whose parents had been deprived of electoral rights for sabotage during the period of collectivization. The extension of the purge throughout the country was not, as sometimes suggested, just the result of too much eagerness on the part of local NKVD officials who let things get out of control. On the contrary, it was insisted on from the center. For example, on November 29, 1936, Vyshinsky was already ordering that within a month all criminal cases of major conflagrations, accidents, and output of poor quality products be reviewed and studied with the aim of exposing a counter-revolutionary and saboteur background in them. In certain areas, where few prosecutions on charges of counter-revolutionary activity had been brought, severe censure was issued from the public prosecutor's office in Moscow. In 1937, only 8 cases in this category were brought to court through a large part of Siberia, and Moscow blamed this on a weak and inadequate struggle to stamp out the nests of saboteurs. Arrest quotas were imposed from above. An NKVD local officer who had been in charge of the small Ukrainian district of Kristianska is reported in jail as telling of an order sent to him to arrest 3,800 people, even arresting all former prisoners. All those reported by Seksots and others would not have fulfilled the quota, so he had to ask village Soviets to nominate lists, himself being arrested for this. At a higher level, The 1938 head of the Belarusian NKVD was reproached for not matching the Ukrainian bag of Polish spies, and managed to pull in 12,000, many of them Jewish shopkeepers. Tilde in general, occasional highly organized mass trials and much more frequent mass arrests marked the period. In May 1937, the Far Eastern Press announced 55 death sentences in such trials. In June,